Before we get into the actual content of the program, I do want to say how thrilled I am to be performing tonight with my colleagues in the orchestra, and I'm sure you all are all very equally thrilled to be here. Thank you. So, of course, we do hope we can continue giving wonderful performances, and that is our intention. It's just thrilling to sort of come back from a bit of a tough holiday season and have a great program on tap and to be able to show you our stuff, I guess, as it were. So that's what we're looking forward to tonight. And as I mentioned, the program consists of our opener, which is the Moldau, also known as Vltava, by Bedřich Smetana. And then that's followed by the Schumann Piano Concerto in A minor, featuring Dror Biran, who is a relatively new faculty member at the University of Louisville in piano. He's from Israel, did some training here in the United States in Cleveland, and you probably read some more of the details, his competition wins and solo engagements. I'm sure those will be listed somewhere in the program. He's a wonderful guy, and I'll talk a bit about him. Then on the second half of the program, we are going to, of course, be performing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Now, these three pieces, as I mentioned, are very well known, frequently performed. We have not performed them all that much recently, particularly the two larger pieces, the Schumann and the Beethoven. Schumann was last performed by the Louisville Orchestra, the concerto, in, I believe it was 1996, so we're looking at about 15 years now. And I know it's been at least 10 years since we did Beethoven 5. It's kind of a treat to get a chance to hear these pieces live. I think sometimes we get used to hearing them just, you know, in the ether. You know, they're on the radio somewhere, or you catch them in the background in a lobby or in an elevator, or maybe you pop it on the CD player or the record player at home. And sometimes the works lose their immediacy a little bit when we don't have a chance to experience them live. Of course, that's, you know, we think that's the best part here at the Louisville Orchestra, and most of us who work in the orchestra business think the best thing about what we do is offering audiences a chance to hear this music come to life right there in front of you live. So it's going to be very exciting to hear these pieces in the flesh tonight, and we'll start with the Smetana. It's actually the most famous of six pieces that Smetana wrote on the theme of homeland, his homeland at the time, what you might call Bohemia, but developing a much stronger, specifically Czech identity during the second half of the 19th century. And these works were written between 1874 and the early 1880s. This is a period of time in European cultural history which is known and noted for its interest in nationalism as a theme that we see in almost all parts of Europe during the second half of the 19th century. And one of the corollaries of that is what happens in music. We begin to see composers and artists of all kinds, actually, sort of looking for themes that tie into this sort of nationalistic ideal. When I say nationalism, I probably should define that just a little bit. Sometimes that word gets a negative connotation, and I think a lot of that has to do with some historical events in the 20th century. In the 19th century, it was much more of a kind of a positive, constructive concept, and we see it manifest itself in all kinds of ways in European life, from the rebuilding of huge cities like Vienna and Paris, to the artwork of the time, particularly in music. We see it in so many composers, and especially composers who were from formerly marginal areas, like Bohemia, which was just kind of a giant, ill-defined area of Eastern Europe with many different nationalities and characteristics. And as the 19th century goes on, some of the borders of these countries that we know now were formed, and the interest in the sort of national identity becomes much, much stronger. Dvořák is a Czech composer who we know quite well from this time, and Smetana is a contemporary, another composer from that same time and place, who's kind of exploring some of the same themes. So he writes these six wonderful pieces. They're actually called Mapvlast, or literally My Homeland, sometimes translated in English as My Country, but homeland sort of has a different connotation than country, particularly talking about some of these areas which were just new on the map during this period of time. And there's still quite a bit of flux in the national borders all the way into the 20th century. So there, in a way, the music is sort of staking a claim to a particular kind of national identity. What's so interesting about this work is it actually takes as its inspiration, a very literal, physical place or series of places, I guess you could say. If you're talking about a river, which is what this one of the six pieces describes, you're never talking about one place, of course. You're talking about all the places that the river flows. And I think it's kind of an apt choice for Smetana to select a river as his theme. In fact, it works very well for a piece of music because, you know, in a way, a piece of music is a bit like, you know, hopping onto a body of moving body of water, and you're on a journey. And as soon as you hit the water, as soon as the first downbeat comes, we begin on this journey, and it continues until you get out of the water. I think maybe that's one of the reasons why this particular movement is the most famous by far of the six pieces that Smetana wrote under the title of My Homeland. What he does in the piece, technically, using the river as his sort of inspiration, as his framework, really, for the piece, he takes us through a series of musical scenes. And it opens very evocatively. Unusually enough, I cannot think of another piece of music that opens with just the second flute player playing, and also the harp. And we have a little pizzicato in the strings, but some of that is almost just more like color. And the second flute player begins the piece alone for two bars. Then the first flute player joins, but they actually don't play together at all for the first 50 bars of the piece. Instead, they overlap, or they dovetail is probably a better way of describing it. The parts just meet in the middle of the bar. So what we hear first is a ripple from the second flute player. Da-di-da-di-da-da-dum. And then again, da-di-da-di-da-da-dum. Then the second, the first flute player, who's the second to play, comes in the second half of that, yadi dadi da 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 di da 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 di da 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 dum, and we begin this little wave. Clarinets join in, and then eventually, as the water becomes more busy, more roiling, the music also begins to develop a little bit more, and that's where we hear this famous first theme from this piece, which is played in the first violins and in the winds. Now, this noodling water music continues almost unabated through all the sections of the piece that describe the river. So you'll hear this noodling 16th figure, yadi da 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 da. What's interesting about it, it's very melismatic. When we say that, it's got a lot of contour, this melody, but it doesn't jump around a lot. It's very descriptive of, you know, what water looks like when it's moving. You can see that it's there's force there, and that there are torrents, you know, pulling underneath the surface. But on the surface, we tend to only see a small amount of what's happening in the water. And so you have a sense of that right from the beginning of the piece. Then we hear this beautiful melody in the first violins, doubled in the upper winds. Which was used as the basis also for the Israeli national anthem. And Dror, who I mentioned, a pianist, is from Israel. We were talking about the program, and I said, well, of course, you know, the Moldau is opening the program. And he said, well, of course, I mean, that's like our national anthem. So that bit of nationalism actually extended into some very real nationalism in the 20th century. This piece by a Czech composer became sort of the basis for one of the world's famous national anthems. In any case, this beautiful melody unfolds very consistently in the violins and in the upper winds. One of the interesting things about the work and the theme is that because he's got this very constantly moving framework for the piece, you don't hear as much of the thematic sort of trading of melodies that you might expect. For example, in the Beethoven, you'll hear a lot of tension derived out of two different sections of the orchestra playing the same material. But in this work, he really does assign certain instruments to be doing certain things, and they mostly stay in that role from beginning to end. So the actual compositional idea behind the piece is a little bit different than, for example, what Beethoven or Schumann might be doing in their works. Over the course of the work, we get sort of several scenes. The first, after the beginning, is a hunting scene. You imagine coming down the river, and maybe I actually have an interesting memory connected to this. My parents took my brother and sister and I on a rafting trip in Alaska when we were kids. I think I was 13 or 14. And one of the things you do, if you've ever done this before, is you go down the river, and then you look on the banks, and the guides point out bear tracks, you know, when they come down to the river. So I suppose on the Moldau, they came down the river and saw hoofs, in, hoof tracks in the sand or something, pulled over and had a hunt. And we hear the hunt intrude on our journey down the river for a few moments. And then that sort of moves into the distance. And we have another scene that comes upon us, which is a peasant wedding. We exit out of that into a almost kind of a metaphorical section. He calls up the idea of these nymphs, these water nymphs, and that's something that is constantly in play in any artwork that deals with water, going all the way back to you know, the Odyssey by Ulysses. I mean, we have that theme. So in a way, he's also connecting this piece not just to the river that he's describing, but also to a whole history of works of about water and about journey in particular. That tends to be where we see these characters. So we sort of know we're in the middle of the journey when we reach the nymph section, which is very arresting. The noodling of the waves, the water waves, still continues along in the flutes and clarinets. But instead we have this almost, I don't really know how to describe it, it's like suspended, weightless sound of the strings floating above this. And then, of all things, the low brass. And just listen as we go through that middle section, very quiet section, to the range in the orchestra. We've got the first violins are playing a few lines above that staff, so they're playing near the top of their range. And we have the tuba and the trombones playing in octaves near the bottom of their range, something that you know, composers have always been interested in exploring. And he does it miraculously effectively. It creates a sense of horizon and calm, which is really remarkable. It's almost the we leave the real world of the river and we enter this sort of dreamscape. We haven't, you know, quite figured out where we are when we actually return back to the river again and hit the rapids. All before you have a chance to breathe, and that's really how it happens on the river. Usually, it looks calm, and then the next thing you know, you're in the rocks, and that's really marked by a lot of overlapping of voices throughout the orchestra. It's one of the most thickly scored things you'll ever see. If you had a chance to look at my score, I guess I should have brought it. Top to bottom, everyone in the orchestra is playing some form of melody. And what we struggle with in those moments from a performance and rehearsal perspective is how to communicate both the individual bits of melody that we think the composer wanted the audience to hear, but also to give the impression of things coming at you from left and right, a lot of noise, a lot of chaos, the way it would be if you were going down a narrow river with rocks all over the place. So it's an interesting balance. It takes us a little bit away from what we normally do, which is try to achieve a perfect balance, you know, so that all voices can be heard. In this, you may hear a voice and then it disappears into the roiling water and then it comes back out again or another voice appears. It's really interesting to hear him change the way he uses the orchestra to communicate some of these things. And then he describes it as the river's entry into the city of Prague is a very triumphal kind of moment at the end of the piece. And this is one of those pieces, like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, that has a kind of an endless ending. It goes on and on and on, and we hear the big chords you expect to hear at the end of the piece, and then we hear them again, and then we hear them again, and then twice as slow, and then twice as slow. And what's really striking about it, I won't tell you if you don't know how it ends, it actually, you would expect in most cases, and finally we get a couple big chords, dun, 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 bah, big cut off and big applause. This ending of this piece takes a very different direction. I'll tell you what it reminds me of, and you can listen as we play it and see what you think. It reminds me of coming out of a wonderful journey like this and that last calm moment as you sort of pull into the dock, and then you turn around and you look and see what you've just beheld from the water. That's kind of how I feel when we get to the end of this piece, and you'll see what you think when you hear it, but it's fun to kind of abandon yourself to a musical journey like this, and I think it'll be a really neat way to begin the program. Let me talk a bit about the Schumann and then break and just see if you have any questions or comments about those two pieces, and then we'll address the Beethoven for a few minutes. Schumann's Piano Concerto is one of the great concertos. It was written in the 1840s, and its premiere was given by Schumann's wife, Clara Schumann, who was a famous pianist already in her teens before she even met Schumann, and then, of course, she helped cement his legacy as a composer, performing his works all around Europe, and also she helped further the careers of other composers like Brahms. So Clara figures largely in this work. In fact, one of the wonderful things about the Schumann story is the personalities of the individuals seem very palpable in the music. I can sort of imagine Schumann working on this piece, having Clara try things out. I can really almost picture her giving the performance, you know, the first time. It's a little bit different than some of the other pieces where we don't have that kind of a backstory. The work itself began as a large one-movement fantasy or fantasia, which is the first movement. And you'll hear that right away. It does begin with this shocking chord out of the orchestra, very sharp, bang, in A minor, and the piano plays this dotted rhythm, da-dum, 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 and we begin the concerto. So it kind of grabs you right by the throat in a way from the beginning, and the actual beginning of the piece doesn't really come for a few bars later. And when you hear that music come back again in the middle section of the piece, he introduces it in a totally different way than he did at the beginning. So the piece itself has more of a fantasia-like feel. I think we would define that as being a little less structured and a little bit more varied than a typical concerto movement. You'll also hear that right in the middle of the first movement, this almost like a march in the orchestra is the role the orchestra has sometimes in this piece is to, you know, very bright, very energetic, vibrant orchestra tutti, and then it sort of melts away into a dreamlike 2 minutes. It comes out of nowhere. Dvorah and I were just working our way through that before the talk started here because we wanted to make sure we were just in the right tempo, just getting the right feel. It's very difficult sometimes in the middle of a fast allegro movement with a lot of energy to all of a sudden allow the music to have the space it needs when the composer, you know, puts the brakes on. And Schumann does this right in the middle of the movement. And then there's a big surprise coming out of that section, and that really leads into the cadenza and then the end of the movement. It's a big movement, the biggest movement of the concerto by quite a bit. You can sort of tell that the piece started that way if you know that. But he decided to expand it into a concerto with three movements. So the middle movement is this delightful andante. And andante, of course, the literal translation of andante is walking. And this movement reminds me of two friends walking together and having a conversation. It starts with the piano, plays four notes, bum, 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 bum. And then the strings in the orchestra play four notes, dun, 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 dun. And then the piano plays four more notes, dun, 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 dee, da, dum. So right away, there's this sense of collegiality in a way. I mean, a conversation, dialogue, and in a sort of easygoing tempo. And then in the middle of the movement, we have a totally different character that pervades much of Schumann's music, is this ethereal beauty that's also somewhat shrouded in tragedy or pain. Schumann himself struggled with what we believe was probably some kind of bipolar condition, a mental illness, and he was institutionalized during his life. So his music often veers sometimes back and forth between a kind of easygoing or kind of happy farmer-esque quality, and then this very wistful character. This section in the middle of the second movement has very large intervals you'll hear in the orchestra. The cellos begin, dee-da, dee-da, dee-da. And it feels like they're almost reaching somewhere. And the interesting thing about this is it just never feels like he quite gets there. He's constantly reaching. There's a very, very similar passage in the slow movement of the First Symphony by Schumann, this kind of reaching gesture that comes through these upward intervals. So not something new to Schumann, but it's still striking to hear it. I mean, this is a piece that's performed all the time, and it's just so beautiful and so stunning to have this in the middle of this otherwise very amiable movement. That conversation returns at the end of that movement. You hear in the distance the march of the orchestra coming back. And it starts very softly in the bassoons and the clarinets, and then it gets louder, louder, and we begin this rollicking third movement, which one of the most interesting things about this for me personally is what happens in the middle of the third movement. There's a theme, very quiet theme in the orchestra. It goes like this. Dum, 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 bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, bum. So when I was growing up, I used to listen to this piece all the time as a kid. And I thought the way that music was written with the beats was like this. Dun, da-dun, dun, dun, da-dun, dun, dun, da-dun, dun, dun, da-dun, dun, dun. Like a march, right? You know, on the beat and everything. But here's how the beat goes in relation to the music, the way Schumann wrote it. Dum, da-dum, bum, bum 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 bum. Now, when you hear that kind of mixture of rhythmic characters, so that's two and three being mixed together, we call that hemiola. And this movement may have more hemiolas than any other piece I've ever seen, because they're happening in almost every bar of the piece. The main theme does not have them, but the secondary theme is full of them, and he uses that to generate a lot of excitement. And if there's anything you could say about this last movement of the Schumann Concerto, is that it's incredibly exciting. It's really fabulous music. You can tell it was written by a pianist and for a pianist. It's wonderfully, beautifully pianistic music. If there's any precedent for it, I would say this piece is to me, in some ways, less resembles the Romantic piano concertos than it does a concerto by Mozart, where the orchestra and the piano are very tightly integrated. There's actually a lot of doubling in the orchestra, where the orchestra is playing some line that the pianist has, but emphasizing it a certain way. It's quite common in Mozart's concertos. And also the fact that it's not a 45-minute gigantic piece like, you know, the Tchaikovsky concertos and some of these other 19th century works for piano and orchestra. It's relatively compact. It almost feels like a classical piece. It's been a great pleasure to play it with Dror this week, and we had not met before we began working on this, but spent some time together kind of woodshedding, going through all the tempos, and what's so much fun about that is learning more about a piece than you thought you might learn, or that you thought was there to learn. That's really the best thing about doing concertos, is being able to exchange those ideas and discover new things. And I think everybody on stage has had that experience this week. So we're excited to do this piece again for the first time in about 15 years. So let's pause. If you have any questions, we can kind of knock them out on the first half and then get a quick 101 on Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which I'm sure is of interest to everybody here. Any questions, thoughts about either Schumann and the concerto or Smetana and his great nationalistic mini-tone poem, the Moldau, which is just a German translation of the Czech word for the river that we're describing. Okay, you've got 5 seconds. We do have a question. Okay. Oh, well, thank you. I'll give you some more then. Someone else is going to have to keep me on track time-wise because I don't have a timepiece, but I think we've got at least 10 or 15 minutes left. Okay, great. 10 minutes to describe the most influential and famous work in the whole symphonic canon. How does that sound? Are you ready? Put your seatbelts on. It is always a great pleasure to perform the music of Beethoven, and also a challenge. Beethoven is, as you know, one of the most unique and interesting artists in any art form throughout history. And I think one of the reasons we do what we do, and one of the reasons we go to museums and go hear orchestras play, is to constantly immerse ourselves in the world and the mind of individuals like this. It gives us an experience that's totally unequaled. So it's very exciting to perform Beethoven, and particularly Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which might be, it certainly is hard to believe it's his most famous work, because he wrote a few famous tunes. It could be the most famous piece of classical music, period. And it certainly is one of the most influential pieces in terms of its impact on other composers. Now, there's this sort of idea that it was just a huge failure when it first came out. Audience didn't understand it, and you know, it took, you know, successive generations to figure it out. Actually, nothing could be really further from the truth. The only reason the first performance of this piece was somewhat of a disaster is because it was placed on a concert which Beethoven gave, a 4-hour concert in 1808, which featured the world premieres of two of his symphonies, the Sixth Symphony first, which is a long piece, 45-minute piece, followed by the Fifth Symphony, a whole bunch of other works, including the Choral Fantasy with orchestra and piano and chorus, in a very cold room. And the orchestra had, like, you know, 3 hours of rehearsal. We think we've got it bad. You know, these guys were in deep trouble with this before the concert even started. And apparently at the concert, the Choral Fantasy had to be stopped and started again at some point. So it just gives you kind of some idea of the difficulties at that first performance. However, within a year or two, contemporaries of Beethoven are writing about this piece as if it's the most important symphonic work on the scene. And so its reputation was cemented right away. However, the orchestra edition itself took some time to firm up. Beethoven had been working on the piece for a number of years, starting in about 1804, but he kept setting it aside for different projects, maybe didn't have the inspiration, maybe just didn't have the right opportunity in terms of a patron and a concert. In any case, he had sketches of the work, including a copy he had made of Mozart's 40th symphony, G minor symphony, in his notebook, upon which it seems relatively certain that he based the third movement of this work. The Mozart Symphony No. 40, last movement, da da ba 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 dum da 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 dum, and this third movement, dee da 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 dee dee da da. It's the same pitches, actually, just a slightly different rhythm. So he was kind of taking ideas, other composers thinking about the symphony for a long time, and then in 1807 sat down to finish it. As a result, there are a number of different drafts of the work, the performing parts from early on, as well as several different engraver proofs that Beethoven did, and it's only just now in the last 15 or 20 years that we've been untangling some of the errors in the text. And tonight you'll get a reasonably faithful interpretation. That's kind of the interpretation we're going for. In fact, I think with Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, the more you let the music stand on its own and try not to mess around with it too much, the more powerful it becomes. And that certainly is foremost in our minds tonight. Now, of course, you all know how the movement begins. I am pretty active blogging at my website, and I blog quite a bit about the concerts I do. So earlier today, I posted up the New Horizons in Music Appreciation by Peter Schickele, which was a concerto for commentators and orchestra based on the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And I was listening to it as I was getting ready to post it this morning, cracking up as usual. But it's quite accurate. It's a wonderful description. I recommend you listen sometime. There may be no better way to learn about the first movement than to listen to Peter, who's a wonderful guy, he's been here a number of times, and his cohorts do a sports commentator version. But they start the piece, and he goes, "Well, it sounds like we've got a four note motif tonight, and there they're off, da 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 dum, da 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 dum. We're having trouble getting started tonight. It seems like the musicians keep stopping." And he's literally describing the piece. It's funny to hear him do it the way he does, but it's quite unprecedented to have a work begin like this. Beethoven, on the other hand, this is a composer whose first symphony starts with a dominant chord, which I don't think anybody had ever done that before. So it's not that Beethoven was a stranger to doing things differently. But in this case, what marks this piece is the intense formal unity of the work. From those first four notes, the whole first movement is just based on those four notes in minor thirds. And it's so simple that it nearly blows the mind to think what he was able to do with these four notes. You'll hear how even in the second theme, which is this beautiful major theme, da-dee-da-da-da-dee-dum, da-da-da-da-dee-da-dum, underneath that lurks the basses or the timpani going da-da-da-dum, ba-ba-ba-bum. It's always there. It's kind of like a heartbeat. There was much talk early on in the history of this piece that da-da-da-dum, those knocking sounds had something to do with fate, although that's been discredited. Another contemporary of Beethoven says it's the sound of a bird call that Beethoven heard, which might be more plausible since Beethoven spent quite a bit of time, particularly in the years before his deafness came on, which is just around this period of time. But I like to instead think of this as really being a very absolute kind of piece. It doesn't need to refer to anything outside itself. Now, of course, it is very striking. The music does sort of start and stop, and I think, in a way, it's sort of characteristic of Beethoven's own impulsive character. Sometimes his music has this quality to it where it might come to rest, and then all of a sudden it's running off in another direction. And so his structure here suits him very well. But if you break the piece down and you go through all the analysis and all that stuff, it actually looks very much like the first movement of a Mozart symphony or a Haydn symphony. And even some of the things which we have traditionally believed were totally groundbreaking about the work, such as the use of trombones and piccolo, were also not new things. Trombones had been in use in some Swedish orchestras earlier in Beethoven's time, as well as in some of the German and Austrian orchestras. And the piccolo had been used by Michael Haydn, which is Franz Josef Haydn's brother, as early as 1770s in orchestra. And these instruments were also used in bands. Now, speaking of bands, we're going to shift to the last movement of Beethoven 5. I've always struggled with this movement. It's kind of like a huge counterweight to the first movement, which is in a really intense C minor. Most of the last movement is in a ridiculously joyous and, you know, ebullient sort of C major. And he chooses as his form for this basically a band march. And so we've got the full brass section, basically everything except percussion that you might expect. Of course, there's timpani, but none of the percussion in a march. In any case, when we started working on it this week, I suggested to the players that because I have a chance to work with them so much in the summer, especially at our patriotic concerts and some of our outdoor things, that they might think to the times we've worked on Sousa together in terms of putting together this last movement. Well, what's the difference? Certainly when you play march music, you're looking for a more rhythmic quality to the sound, to the articulation of the notes. There's less sustain. So, for example, in the second movement to the third movement, where we have these longer legato lines, in this movement, we're thinking a little bit more about this kind of rhythmic articulation that goes through the movement. And, of course, the instrumentation, you'll become apparent right away, harkens very much to a contemporary march of Beethoven's. And this, again, is just a masterful movement. It's incredible. It doesn't begin really the way most finales begin. It actually comes out of that third movement I mentioned, which he sort of used... for which he used Mozart as his precedent. But interestingly enough, right in the middle of the action in the fourth movement, we do have a return of some earlier material. And when that material arrives, I think that's the point at which it becomes clear how much the whole piece is tied together around these four notes. You hear them at the beginning, ba-ba-ba-bam, and then we hear them in the second movement rhythmically for the most part. There's a whole passage where the cellos and violas play da-da-da-dun-dun-dun-dun. Ba-ba-ba-bum-bum-bum-bum. It's kind of a hidden sort of reference to those four notes. Then in the middle of the third movement, we have this main theme, which is da-da-da-dum, ba-ba-ba-bum, ba-da-ba-bum. Now the emphasis, the rhythmic emphasis, changes from da-da-da-dum to da-da-da-da. So the rhythmic emphasis is shift. But in that last movement, when we hear it come back, it's almost a kind of an epiphany. This one little motif is the glue for the whole work. But the way that he exposes us to that over the course of the work is really the master stroke. You're not quite aware of that being there. And yet when the piece is over, to me sometimes it feels like this work is all in one movement, even though the sections are so distinct. Because he's found a way to glue them together with this motif in such a unique way, audacious way. I don't think any composer would have done something so audacious as to take such a small rhythmic and melodic cell and use it as a basis for the whole work. But Beethoven does it, and it's a very, very sort of fascinating study. It's inspired even some of the most tricky and technically minded 20th century composers, particularly the 12-tone composers, who love the idea of a small cell being able to generate the whole piece. So Beethoven in this piece is speaking to musicians across history. It's really fascinating. And of course, it's also extremely exciting to hear and perform. So I think you'll enjoy that part of it. Since we're basically nearing the end of our time, I do want to see if you've got any questions about the work or how it came about or Beethoven. Yes. You know, it's an interesting question because C major and C minor are very common keys for Beethoven. And then he's got this second movement in what we call the flat subdominant. So it's got a totally different character to it. In fact, one of the things I notice about the second movement is its ambiguity. And I think the reason he chose this key was to heighten the sense of ambiguity, because C minor and C major for Beethoven mean... you know, this is, you know, this kind of heroic struggle or this heroic achievement on either side of that major minor line. And A flat, especially in relation to C major, which is, you know, the relative minor would be A minor. It's picking a remote key to the C major, C minor gives the whole movement a feeling of ambiguity. And then even when it starts, dee-da-dum, dee-da-da, dee-da, he goes from major to minor in the first bar, and the whole melody has that characteristic to it. It's quite ambiguous at times. There are also a few moments where the music just gets hung up entirely in this key. You'll notice it right after the opening melody. The violins play dee-da-da, dee-da-da, stop on a G flat, and everything just seems to stop for a moment. And I think Beethoven needed this to balance out this. Just there's so much C minor and C major in this piece, it's actually unbelievable how much of those keys are in the piece. And the second movement, I think, helps us, gives a little relief from it and provides a counterbalance. Second movement, I think, may actually be, well, it may not be as long as the fourth movement, but it's a very long movement relative to the other movements around it. And so I think he's thinking structurally across the whole piece from the beginning of the first movement to the end of the last movement. And that second movement is a key component in the balance between all of the movements, all of the modulations and the tonality, and of course the strictness of this rhythmic thing. So I think that's why he chose such a remote key for that movement. It is, though, a beautiful movement as well. It has this characteristic of an aria, is what we were talking about in rehearsal. Cellos get a chance to really sing in this movement, so it's a nice thing. We have a wonderful cello section, so you'll get to hear them in their full glory this evening. Any other questions or comments before we break? Thank you all for coming tonight. I hope you enjoy the performance.